We're talking about help for renters to prevent evictions on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Earlier this month, the Treasury Department announced 665,000 households have secured aid through the Emergency Rental Assistance Program. That's the federal level data in November. Here in Wisconsin, the state's Emergency Rental Assistance Program announced it gave out $100 million in payments to over 22,000 households since the start of the pandemic. So those numbers in mind, are you struggling to afford rent? Where have you found help? How quickly was your application processed? How should communities invest in permanent affordable housing? 800-642-1234. Andy Height is Housing Policy and Program Manager at the Wisconsin Community Action Program, also known as WISCAP, part of a national network that works on solutions to poverty and housing. Andy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, good morning. Glad to be here.
Good morning. You're in the thick of housing challenges in our state, so lay it out for us. What are the circumstances you're finding with some renters?
There's a myriad of circumstances, Kate, and it's pretty frightening to be in a situation of rent instability where you don't know for sure if that roof is going to be over your head tomorrow. It's even worse when you have health issues or young children in the home. Our program's working in 68 of 72 Wisconsin counties, and we've got out $100 million. Those other four counties, which are the large counties, run their own programs. They're nearly at another $100 million distributed. So as a whole, Wisconsin's distributed nearly $200 million in rent assistance, yet it's just the tip of the iceberg. I don't think anyone would have predicted the pandemic would still be going strong 21 months later. There's only 18 months of assistance available under this program, which is significant, but it isn't enough for some of our lowest income Wisconsinites. And so it creates a frightening dynamic, and the needs of the rent burden are not met by the amount of affordable housing, permanent affordable housing that's available anywhere in this state.
Yeah, we've been talking with mayors from all over Wisconsin, and they all tell us the same thing, that there just isn't good housing and enough housing for people whose income and wages are low. So if that be true, that there is this real scarcity of supply all over, how does that affect the work you're doing?
Well, it means we're treading water and helping families at the moment, helping households at the moment, but not laying the groundwork for permanent solutions. So are we putting a Band-Aid over the crisis for when we have the next economic upheaval, or is it just going to be a slow, percolating nightmare for people facing eviction? The American Recovery Plan Act put millions of dollars into the hands of localities, and frankly, that significant amounts of those dollars could be used to build permanent affordable housing. And it isn't happening to any great extent anywhere in the state or anywhere in the country. So, I mean, unfortunately, the mayors, the county executives of this world have their hands in this too. We all share part of the blame and part of the burden for this inequitable situation we've got with housing.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Andy Height, who is Housing Policy and Program Manager at WISCAP. That's the Wisconsin Community Action Program, working in 68 of 72 counties on this housing issue. You can join in with what you've seen in your community with housing, 800-642-1234. So what does help from the rental assistance program look like? What is the process? What does it cover?
Well, those good questions. We'll start. People have to have a COVID-related impact on their household income, number one. Number two, rent assistance can cover up to 18 months of assistance, full rent. It's generally back rent, and it can go up to 3 months prospective rent or into the future. It also could cover utilities, phone, water bill, a stipend for internet. So the household expenses it takes to live in housing. And some people are, you know, truly struggling. Talk to a man from a household. He was hospitalized for 47 days with COVID and about two-thirds of the way from through that hospitalization, he was literally laid off by his employer. And so they're between their medical bills and their housing bills. It's a nightmarish quandary that's hard to even imagine or talk about.
Do you find landlords less lenient, less flexible as the pandemic wears on into a third year?
I think everybody's wearing out and that there is a fatigue. I think that there's a lot of landlords that have worked really hard with this program to try to get their tenants benefits because they believe in those tenants and watch that situation unfold, either in the houses they're managing or even in their own extended network of family and friends. There's also landlords that have lost patients and are quick to file evictions. And the fact of the matter is we've put up people in hotels, we've hired additional housing navigators, but when there isn't available units to navigate people to, you almost need training in the mystic arts as opposed to housing navigation, because we can't just create more affordable housing out of thin air.
You mentioned motels. People living in motels do face a greater risk of eviction because there are the rental rules, there may be city ordinance in effect. What about the risk of motel living? Can you go into that?
Well, first and foremost, most of them don't have cooking facilities. So what does that do to your diet? And the space, if a family of four is in a motel room for a length of time, that's, you know, the challenges around privacy and sometimes just needing your space to, I don't know, occasionally primal scream or vent. And when you're in that kind of situation, it's clearly stressful, often traumatizing, and so that tight quarters can create real difficulties. But surely it's a bit better than trying to weather the temperatures outdoors.
How big of an issue do you find is overcrowding in housing in Wisconsin?
That's a good question, and I don't know that I have the hands-on experience to answer it accurately. I just know that people will double and triple up to help their neighbors, their friends, and people they care about when communities are coming together to support each other, and sometimes it becomes an any means necessary struggle to keep a roof over their heads. But our average family size of the about 23,000 cases that we've worked with, so that's 22,000 households, about 68,000 individuals. The average family size is only about just under four.
Mm.
We see some pretty large families, and we see some pretty complex situations. And that's the number families are reporting. And I have to take people at their word because I think people are generally honest at their core.
Let's bring on a caller, Tammy, joining us from Omro. Tammy, hi. What's on your mind? Oh, I'm sorry. Tammy just left us, but I believe Tammy was wondering about whether you need a vaccination in order to get rental assistance. Do you have to have a COVID vaccine or show proof of vaccine in order to get assistance? I believe that what Tammy was driving at.
Okay, no, absolutely not. This program has been in effect since before there was a vaccine. Now, there are many different, some people are able to apply online, some people use regular mail, some people are sending in their applications with photos taken from their telephone.
Mm.
Some agencies will do masked and distance face-to-face meetings. And some have their doors open now, and their Wisconsin Community Action Program Association is a network of 18 agencies. 16 of them are regional community action agencies, and they're in 69 of the 72 counties. And then we have two statewide organizations in our network: United Migrant Opportunity Services, doing direct outreach to migrant populations, and the Foundation for Rural Housing, which helps people in rural areas preserve their housing.
We're talking with Andy Height, Housing Program Manager at WISCAP, the Wisconsin Community Action Program, operating around the state through this network. Should the state do more to help people struggling to keep a roof over their head? What do you see as the root causes of eviction? Should the U.S. Treasury Department be spending about $25, $30 billion on rental assistance? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up in a minute with Andy Height here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing efforts in Wisconsin to stop evictions and long-term solutions to housing. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kant. WISCAP, the Wisconsin Community Action Program, has been on the ground floor helping thousands of households in our state at risk for eviction get rental assistance. So what is it like to be a renter? Have you faced eviction before? Are you a landlord? Let's hear from you. What do you see? What are your biggest concerns and challenges? 800-642-1234. Andy Height leads housing policy at WISCAP with us for about 9 more minutes. Andy, earlier in the pandemic, we heard reports of applicants saying, look, there is a lot of red tape here. It takes a long time to fill out these application forms for assistance. How long are applications? What is that like now?
It's still a challenge, even though this is probably one of the most efficient and generous economic support programs that I've ever seen that's available to folks. We're asking people to apply for energy assistance so we can leverage that funds for their utility costs. The actual rent assistance application is fairly simple. It requires an attestation of the impact of COVID on your household income. It requires verification or self-report of income. And then it requires a landlord attestation that the tenant and landlord signed describing what is owed. With the second iterations with funds we have, if the landlord isn't cooperative, the tenant can do that attestation. We try to reach out to the landlord. If they refuse to cooperate, the tenant can get the payment directly and submit the funds to the landlord in the program counties, the 68 counties we're running programs in. Although we've seen very few cases where the landlords have chosen not to participate because, you know, they're in the business to get paid their rent and provide housing to people.
So even if landlords get their back due rent, are you encountering issues where property owners aren't renewing the lease? And I say that because I read about that problem going on in Chicago. The rental assistance paperwork got filled out correctly. Money from the government got through. Tenants paid up, months back due, and landlords declined to renew leases.
That's absolutely an issue, Kate. You hit it on the head. A lot of landlords during the pandemic didn't want to force people to move, so they went to month-to-month leases, which requires only a 30-day notice, written notice, before folks have to move. We will fund a security deposit and up to 3 months forward rent, and have been monitoring the security deposits weekly. And for many, many weeks, we were averaging between 25 to 35 security deposits assistance provided in our service area. Last week was 50. It's crept up since the end of the eviction moratorium, and that's clearly an issue that's happening. And when leases are renewed, rents are higher. And rents seem to be rising higher than the rate of inflation and higher than the rate of wages, which is why I describe this program as, unfortunately, a Band-Aid on the issue of permanent affordable housing and how it impacts people that are rent burdened. You know, they say the formula is, in theory, you should be paying 30% of your income towards rent. Mm-hmm. In reality, Wisconsinites are paying a lot more than this. We're fairly rapidly becoming a high rent state coupled with being a relatively low wage state. And that's a bad formula for tenants, especially lower income tenants and households.
Andy, let me ask you this. With this Band-Aid that you keep referring to, what happens to tenants who continue to face eviction even after receiving rental assistance money through the program?
I think that there's a lot of different answers. The end of the story isn't written, but we have a political dynamic where the two parties in control aren't able to work together to try to find constructive solutions in terms of investing resources through the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority, or WEDA, as well as WEDEC, the Wisconsin Economic Development Commission. We have the temporary respite of these federal funds from the American Recovery Plan Act, probably a little bit of support from the Infrastructure Act, but it doesn't look like the politicians in D.C. can figure out how to disobey their corporate masters and find a way to fund housing at a more permanent level in the United States. So I think this is a problem that's going to be with us for a long time, and talking about it may lead to pathways to solutions, but it's really hard to set your GPS coordinates to those absolute solutions. We've got work to do, Kate.
We're talking with Andy Height, who is Housing Policy and Program Manager at WISCAP, the Wisconsin Community Action Program. You can join in. How should communities invest in permanent affordable housing? Have you sought help from local nonprofits to stay afloat? How did that go? 800-642-1234. This is another sensitive issue I want to bring up. Does this rental assistance require a person to be a legal resident of the U.S.?
No, they just have to be living in the state of Wisconsin and affected by COVID. The Wisconsin Emergency Rental Assistance Program does not discriminate based on citizenship.
Plain and simple, full stop there. I want to move on. There is a power imbalance between renters and landlords, and that is simply true. It's a fact. Renters, they also need access to legal counsel at times. They might need access to mediation as a tenant. How do tenants get help ensuring their rights when they are in this crisis situation and months behind on rent?
Great question. Our local agencies are consistently referring to Legal Action and Judicare, who are the legal aid entities across the state. Some of our agencies have worked in partnership with other entities to find funding for attorneys specific to folks facing eviction court. We work with the state. We get through Wisconsin Circuit Court Automation Project. Every week we get the reports of people who have evictions filed on them, and we send them a postcard with the emergency rental assistance information that connects them back to their agency, and our agencies are trying to reach out to folks facing eviction. Our agencies are swamped, so that's an imperfect process, but most of the time, tenants and landlords are willing to find a mediated solution. The problem is, and you mentioned that power imbalance, if you cannot meet the criteria of that mediated solution, you have to leave your apartment automatically evicted without the court process. But we've been able to at least stem some of the tides, because we know evictions are terrible for people and traumatizing for any individual, but especially the young children in those households. And how does that really affect their learning, their language acquisition, their problem-solving skills? And what kind of groundwork does that lay for the future as they navigate the pitfalls and vagaries of their existence?
Sounds like nonprofits and government are in a patchwork approach, perhaps, to trying to work on this problem. Does Wisconsin have any formal eviction diversion programs where it's more of a seamless process?
I think communities, Dane County and Milwaukee County, La Crosse County, have some exemplary programs that nonprofits and folks on the ground have built in partnership with the municipal courts and others overseeing the eviction. But ultimately, it is fairly piecemeal. It's intentional in communities, but there isn't that statewide planning. In fact, I believe it's three times over the last 15 years the Wisconsin legislature has rewritten the landlord-tenant code to increasingly swing the pendulum towards landlords. That has not helped the situation for vulnerable tenants in any way, shape, or form.
We only have about 20 seconds left, Andy, but I just want to get a sense of where you see your work headed this year. What might come next?
Well, two things. We're working with our agencies and their partners to try to build innovative, permanent, affordable housing projects that we can find ways to fund so we can start to chip away at the extent of this program. Also, hopefully by the end of February, we'll be running a homeowner assistance program that'll be similar, except it'll be impacting homeowners affected by COVID, whether they have mortgage, tax, or other arrearages, so we can keep vulnerable homeowners in their homes across Wisconsin. So there's definitely more to come and a ton of work to do.
Andy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for your work. Really appreciate the opportunity to talk about housing on public radio.
Andy Height, Housing Policy and Program Manager at WISCAP. We have a link to the Wisconsin Emergency Rental Assistance Program at WPR.org/mornings. Ahead this hour, it's your thoughts on the Packers in the NFC playoffs. How do you think the 49ers will fare at Lambeau Saturday night? Temps in the teens, 800-642-1234. News update is next on the Ideas Network. We're talking Packers in the divisional round of the NFC playoffs. Your predictions wax poetic on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer. Kent, they host the 49ers Saturday night at Lambeau. Here's Aaron Rodgers reflecting at a press conference earlier this week on, you know, shiny Super Bowl type thingies.
So much of it is focused on the wins and losses, especially in the playoffs, Super Bowl rings and all that stuff. I understand that's part of my legacy. I'll be judged on when I'm done playing. And every year is important.
Audio courtesy of the Green Bay Packers. What do you think of the Pack's chances in their journey this season? 800-642-1234. Pete Doherty is a Packers columnist for the Green Bay Press Gazette and USA Today Network Wisconsin, where he's covered the Packers since 93. Pete, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thanks for having me back, Kate.
Well, so here we go again. You know, Packers starting their playoff journey at home. Let's rewind just for a moment as a setup. How did they look to you this season? 13 wins, number one seed.
Good. I think, you know, they're a tad better than they were last year. They're not statistically, they're not as good on offense. They had the leading scoring offense in the league last year. And their numbers aren't quite the same, but I think they're about as good. And I think they're a tad better on defense, and probably more than anything, I think they're a little more seasoned. The coach is a young coach who's a year older, a year more experienced. And they maybe learned an important lesson last year that, you know, just because you get home field advantage for the playoffs doesn't mean you get to the Super Bowl. They got beaten the championship game at Lambeau by Tampa Bay. And I suspect that made a strong impression on guys. You know, we won't know till the postseason is over, but I think they're a tad better than last year. That's my impression.
A tad better. You know, I watched the 49ers against the Rams, and I had to say, I was pretty impressed with the 49ers' grit at the end, because LA, they were leading for most of the game. 49ers didn't get on the board till like the second quarter. And it was really in the fourth, like it was a field goal in overtime that decided it. It really makes me wonder whether the Pack will also jump out to a quick lead and what that could spell for the fourth.
Yeah, these games, they're not, you know, they're not over just because you're up 14-0. You got to put the hammer down when you get a team down. The Niners are good. They have a handful of great players, which is what a lot of this game comes down to. They got a couple on defense with Nick Bosa and Fred Warner. You know, Bosa's a pass rusher, Warner inside linebacker. At Debo Samuel, I don't know if you know, you saw the receiver running back. I mean, that guy is a stud. He is really, really good. So they've got plenty of big time talent. And I think they match up okay with the Packers because they run the ball well. That's their thing, is Kyle Shanahan's zone running scheme, and everything's based off that. And the Packers were really up and down defending the run. At times, their outside, their edge guys were really good at holding the edge and stopping the run, especially in the first half of the season. They did well against the 49ers. They played in week three, but Packers really had some issues with that later in the season. The Cleveland game really jumps out, and the 49ers have different backs now. This Elijah Mitchell is their starter now, and the way they're using Samuel, he's basically their number two, because he was hardly a factor in the running game in that first one. So they're going to attack the Packers' edges in the run game. And to a large degree, I think, you know, that's one area where this the winner of this game is going to be determined.
Do you think the Packers' defense can take advantage of turnover opportunities in the game? This game, what will turnovers really look like here, do you think?
Yeah, they're big, and, you know, Garoppolo is – he's a decent quarterback, and he's has his moments, but
I like
as he
that.
Does against
– That's a very fair description.
And as he – you know, as you saw in the, you know, in the game last week, I mean, they had that game kind of won in the fourth quarter.
Uh-huh.
And he – that big interception, and, you know, that got the Cowboys right back into it. So the thing he'll do is a couple times a game, he'll make a bad decision, get hurried into a bad decision. He threw an interception the first time these teams played. So, yeah, it's probably going to be important. You know, Rodgers doesn't turn it over. So if they turn over Garoppolo once or twice, that would be huge. I mean, the NFL stats are overwhelming. If you win the turnover battle, you know, your chances of winning the game are really high. Like in the, you know, even if you win by one turnover, I think it's in the 70%, somewhere in there.
Well, maybe Garoppolo would tell you, you know, we are human. We are mortals after all, Pete.
We are. And some of us are more mortal.
Oh, dear. I don't know if you're going to go there. We're talking with Pete Doherty, Packers columnist for the Green Bay Press Gazette, USA Today Network, Wisconsin. Covered the Packers for decades. You can join in on your prediction Saturday night, 800-642-1234. We've got to talk field goal kicker Mason Crosby. Missed 3 field goals against the Bengals in week 5. He's hit 18 of the 27 field goal attempts this year. What's going on there?
Well, probably a couple things. One, they changed long snapper. The operation, the snap, hold, kick operation has gotten to be this really scientific, detailed process in the NFL. And when anything goes wrong now, these guys will miss kicks. And they changed the long snapper in the middle of the season. And that's when the misses started. They have a new punter this year. And the rap on this guy was that he wasn't a very good holder at his other stops. So I think it took a while to get that operation down, you know, once the downturn hit in the Bengals game. And, you know, Crosby's, I think he's 37. You know, that's getting up there. And kickers last longer than other guys, but that's still getting pretty old. And so maybe, you know, age is becoming a little bit of an issue for him too. He has kicked a lot better in the last, the operation's been a lot better in the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 weeks, but he did miss, I think he missed an extra point against Detroit. So, you know, if you're looking for things to worry about, you know, you could worry about that.
Well, I worry about kicking in the cold. It's hard to kick in the cold.
It is. The ball's hard. It doesn't go as far. One of the things is, you know, with the age is, you know, his kickoffs aren't as deep now. And with how bad their special teams coverage units have been through most of the season, I'm sure they're, you know, they'd much prefer just kicking the ball into the end zone and giving it up at the 25 for a touchback. But I would think, especially if it's going to be, you know, under 10 degrees, Crosby will probably have a tough time getting at the end zone. I'm not saying you won't be able to, but it's going to be a little tougher. So they might be, you know, prone to giving up a longer kickoff return. In fact, I just rewatched the first game against San Francisco, and the Packers were dominating the first quarter and a half or first quarter.
Mm-hmm.
Up, like, I don't know, a 60 or 70 yard kickoff return. And that led to a touchdown for the Niners at the end of the half. And that basically kept the Niners in the game.
So, you know, it's always fun with Lambeau because you have the elements, and it's almost like this old side game when you talk about weather in the mix. What impact will these really frigid temperatures have on this game and with the 49ers in town?
Yeah, it depends on just how frigid it gets. It was for other purposes, I just happened to talk to Brett Favre last week, and he was saying that when it gets just bitter, bitter cold, really, even then, the bigger problem is the wind, because you just can't control the ball. So if you think back to the 2000 championship game, that was fairly windy. They played the Bears in even a colder game earlier that year. And Favre said and the wind was whipping. He said you just couldn't even throw the ball at all. Rodgers has said the same thing. Rodgers kind of says the cutoff is at about 10 degrees. If it's 10 degrees or warmer, the ball handling really isn't that big a problem, but when it gets below 10, the ball gets slicker and a little tougher to throw. So that's probably something to look for is, the two things to look for is it below 10 and how much below 10 it is, and then how windy it is.
And that wind chill factor too, because that wind chill factor can really have an impact as well. You know, we didn't really talk too much about who's healthy, who's not, but what does the offensive line configuration look like? Is it healthy? And what will LaFleur, what will his approach be there in terms of who he puts in and who's healthy?
So, we don't know for sure. During training camp, practice is open, the whole practice, and everything is available for the public, for reporters to report. In the regular season, practice is only open for, they do individual drills for a while. Once they do 11-on-11, reporters are kicked out, so you don't see who they're lining up. Bakhtiari did not practice because the game's on Saturday. They practice Tuesday. He did not practice Tuesday, but they did the same thing the week before the Lions game. They give him a load management day off because of that, you know, as he's coming back from this knee injury. He was limited yesterday, which means he took part in anywhere from one team snap to all but one. So it's such a huge range. We really don't know, but he did not practice full time. My guess is, you know, with the way he played better than you would have thought against Detroit in 27 snaps, my guess is, unless something has cropped up, he's going to be their left tackle. Billy Turner's been out for a few weeks, the knee injury. Sounds like he's back. I'm guessing he'll be the right tackle. Myers, their rookie center, Josh Myers, just came back against Detroit. I think he's going to be the center. So they're going to have three guys who, one has basically not played all year. Myers has been out since, I'm thinking, mid-October maybe, and Turner for a month. So they're good players, but they've missed some time. So that is, you know, that's a question, is how's the timing and communication going to be? And with Bakhtiari, how sharp is he going to be, and how's his conditioning over, you know, 60 or 65 snaps going to be? But my guess is that will be their starting offensive line. And that would be the first time all those guys have played together all year.
Wow. Pete Doherty with us, sports columnist for the Green Bay Press Gazette, USA Today Network, Wisconsin. Do you think this could be Rodgers' last season with the Pack? If the Packers make it to the Super Bowl, I know, don't look ahead. What team do you want to see them play? How are you feeling about the 49ers at this point? Still time, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Pete Doherty here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the Packers taking on the 49ers in the divisional playoff game at Lambeau Saturday night. Are you there? This is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What are your expectations for Rodgers? How do the Packers look to you? Seriously, how do they look? Are you worried about COVID spread in Brown County due to the game? Join in 800-642-1234. Green Bay Press Gazette Packers columnist Pete Doherty with us for about 10 more minutes. So, Pete, according to the Green Bay Press Gazette, a paper you might know of, neither Packers nor Brown County Public Health have said whether games at Lambeau have been COVID spreader events this season. What about Omicron in Lambeau? How do you imagine the fans will conduct themselves?
I think they will conduct themselves as they always do, which means they'll spend a few hours before the game having a lot of fun. and they'll be at full throat during the game. I mean, I haven't researched this to death. It does seem like from the evidence that's out there that, you know, if you're outdoors, the spreading of the coronavirus is much, much, much more limited than if you're indoors. I haven't seen anything about any NFL game where that's looked like a super spreader event. So, I don't think there's any anticipation that there's going to be a big problem there.
Well, do you know anything of Packers management trying to ensure that players are safe and don't become ineligible to play due to a COVID infection?
Yeah, I think they've gone to advanced protocols. You know, I think everybody's masking up in the building, like in their meetings, they're distancing. The one thing with the way that the coronavirus spread so widely through a lot of teams, through the whole league, kind of from the middle and later portions of the season, a lot of guys are, you're not completely immunized if you get it, but, there's a lot of protection there once you get it. And so a lot of guys are protected by that. And, a fair amount of them, I think the number is 95% were vaccinated. Now I suspect that number is lower and that there were more Antonio Browns out there. Hmm. There's a handful on each team who got fake vaccination cards. I wouldn't be surprised at all if that were the case. But so it's still a large percentage of guys got it. And a lot of guys have gotten boosted. So the one, I guess, if you want to say positive thing about the big run of Corona, of the Omicron variant, is so many people on all these teams got it that probably there are fewer guys who are susceptible to catching it, over the next month because they already had it.
Well, let me ask you this. Rodgers violates the NFL's COVID protocols. Fine. He was irked about having to be masked at press conferences as an unvaccinated player. Does he have the same clout among fans, with those COVID tensions going on and as they think about who will be season MVP?
As far as fans go, I think it just depends on the person. I think he lost some fans for sure for not being upfront about not being vaccinated. I don't know if that's a temporary loss or if they'll, stay mad at him. I think winning a Super Bowl will probably soften at least some of those people. The MVP voters, that's done. The official MVP is done by the Associated Press. There are 50 voters. It's all media, one in each market, and then 18 NFL market, and then 18 at-large voters. They also voted for the All-Pro team.
Mm-hmm.
Rob won the quarterback, first-team All-Pro. I think he had 34 votes, and Brady had 16. That's a pretty strong sign that Rodgers is going to win the MVP. I would be looking at those numbers, I'd be stunned if he does not win the MVP.
Well, in all this Rodgers talk, let's go to Doug now in Green Bay. Hi, Doug.
Hey, Pete. I don't know what that feeling is. Since this, I'm a big sports fan, I'm watching all these talk shows. And it seems like Rodgers likes to have all this conversation around him as to what he's doing next year. I feel like he could have squashed it by now by saying, So what do you feel? Like, is he going to come back or not? Or would the Packers hold him back?
Okay, so Rodgers chatter, will he come back or not? What is the future?
Yeah, that is a really big question. And there's no knowing. I think in part, a lot depends on how the season finishes out, and even how it finishes out could cut both ways. If it ends early, is he going to decide it's not happening here and want to move on? Are the Packers going to decide it's not happening here and they might as well trade him and get what they can for him if they win the Super Bowl? Is Rodgers going to feel like he's fulfilled his obligations? And if he wants to move on, to ask to move on. Maybe it's easier for the Packers to trade him if they win the Super Bowl because they could say, well, we got the championship. Now let's get what we can for him. So it's really tough to know. But the strongest thing that, I feel comfortable saying is when training camp started, I would have put the odds at least 90-10 that he's gone.
Hmm.
It just looked like there was minimal chance that he was going to be back. And then he shows up on time. That diffused things a lot. He didn't miss any practice. Things seemed completely normal from the start of training camp, of going to all the practices. And with the way things have gone, you know, he seems to have, he's really softened. He's praised the front office for hearing him out on personnel issues, for the moves they've made. Brian Kutakunst by name, he's praised, who he had the problem with. I would say the odds of him coming back have improved dramatically. 50-50, maybe a little better. But there's still so much depends on how the season finishes out. And we don't know what he's really thinking deep down. Last year, I would never have guessed that he was as upset as he was with how he conducted himself in Zoom press conferences. He seemed really mellow and zen. And it turns out he was harboring some real resentment against the organization. So we don't know how he really feels, but I would say it's probably at least 50-50 he's back, but you know, these things will be determined, you know, in February sometime probably.
Doug, it's a coin toss. How does that work for you? Doug, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. You hear me?
Yep.
I just want to know what the contract issue is. I mean, if the Packers really didn't want to trade him, they could keep him, right? Because he's under contract next year, right? Even though the salary cap number is huge.
Yeah, that's correct. He's got a year left on his contract. Now, the salary cap number is huge, and he only has the 1 year left, so they could only restructure it with his permission and add years on. So if he doesn't want back, he could just not restructure the contract, and then, you know, their cap issues would be a huge problem. But you are right. He's got a year left, and if they don't want to trade him, they don't have to, and there's really not much he could do about it other than, you know, not show up.
Doug, thanks for the call. We only have a minute or so left, and I want to ask you, circling back to this game on Saturday. So, you know, if you put Rodgers and Garoppolo side by side, and you throw down some strengths and weaknesses in each of those areas, what is that head-to-head showdown looking like to you with these quarterbacks?
Obviously it's a really big advantage for the Packers. I was just thinking, you know, during the commercial break, if you were ranking the 32 quarterbacks, the starters in the league, I mean, Garoppolo's not bad, and the 49ers record with him is way better than without him when he's been hurt. But he probably ranks around somewhere from 12 to 15, I would guess. And Rodgers is top two or three in this quarterback-driven league. So that's the Packers' big edge. It's their edge into almost every game they go into. And it's the main reason why they're, 4.5, 5.5-point favorite for this game.
Well, Pete, always good to talk to you. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me, Kate, anytime.
Pete Doherty is a Packers columnist for the Green Bay Press Gazette and USA Today Network, Wisconsin, where he's covered the Packers for decades. Just ahead, we'll rediscover forgotten female pioneers of science with the co-founders of the Lost Women of Science Initiative. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.